better drug for treating mood disorders and his psychodynamic perspective, which asserted that our own minds play tricks on us, that unconscious processes that elude awareness guide our conscious lives, and that the human sex drive spurs personality development from infancy into adulthood. A number of followers who initially intended only to expand upon his theory, like Carl Jung, Karen Horney, and Erik Erikson, each came to veer away as their ideas came to contradict his, often beginning with disagreements over sexuality's role. Rather than minimize the importance of the unconscious mind like some neo-Freudians, Carl Jung emphasized it more heavily than Freud, adding a deeper dimension popular in the study of heroes, the collective unconscious shared throughout our species. Despite controversies, both Freud and Jung remain influential to this day and provide frameworks for analyzing fictional characters and their stories. Most psychologists are not Freudians. Freud's ideas frequently lacked falsifiability, disprovability, meaning that no conceivable empirical outcome could have contradicted him. He said stairways in dreams represent sexual intercourse. You can't prove that wrong any more than you can prove that no organ grinder ever played cribbage in any of your ancestors' kitchens. Einstein asserted that faster than light travel is impossible. Because a single superluminal jaunt would refute his assertion, the idea itself, whether right or wrong, was scientific. One important reason why Carl Jung broke away from Freud was that Jung, although a religious man, felt that dogma in any form, in Freud's case, his insistence that sexual foundations underlay all psychological development, had no place in an empirical discipline. Nevertheless, we can easily speculate on what Freud might have said about Batman. He said a great deal about how traumatic experiences will affect boys at around the age Bruce was when his parents died. Freud's psychodynamic foundations. The cornerstone of Freud's psychoanalysis was his view that the unconscious mind continually influences us in ways the conscious mind does not realize. In his view, early experiences shape personality and create inner conflicts we wrestle with throughout our lives. This unconscious turmoil stirs up difficulties in conscious life. He felt that we have two main instincts driving our behavior. A life instinct that he called Eros, for the Greek god of erotic love, and a death instinct he called Thanatos, for the Greek god of death. He had much more to say about the life instinct. We spend all our time being alive, and only a certain portion of it focusing on death and destruction. The life instinct, or libido, all mental energy, would drive sex, activity, construction, creativity, hunger, and all the activities involved in keeping us and our species going, the kind of things for which Playboy Bruce Wayne pretends to live. So Batman's ongoing effort to save lives as a life-oriented activity would be his form of sexual expression on planet Freud. Seeing this as one wide-ranging instinct, Freud considered it all sexual in nature. The death instinct, on the other hand, would prompt aggression, destruction, and preoccupation with morbid topics. Dwelling on this could create antisocial or suicidal inclinations. The death instinct can serve life. Sometimes you need to fight off the wolves. Sometimes you must demolish one thing in order to build another. Batman's aggression and his terrifying image help him shield others from fates like his family's. A Freudian might take the view that the three-part Batman character, Bruce facade, Batman as superhuman symbol, and the real man behind both, represents the three major structures of personality. Not that they directly are the three structures, simply that they could symbolize them. At the beginning of life, personality consists of nothing but id, the innate animal self-driven by those inborn instincts. It operates on the pleasure principle, seeking immediate gratification, immediate fulfillment of needs and desires. Playboy Bruce would embody the id. Around age 3, we develop the ego, the executive structure that includes the conscious mind and learns to operate on the reality principle. Whereas an infant has no concept of patience, no initial tolerance for waiting, children will learn that we can often achieve greater satisfaction by waiting. Because Batman is the main self, the identity that all Bruce's other efforts support, he might represent the ego. When his surrogate mother, Dr. Leslie Tompkins, gestures to the bat insignia on his chest and says, "This isn't the real you, Bruce," he tells her, "It's the only me there is, Leslie." Batcave Bruce, the hero unmasked and partially costumed down in the Batcave, the one place he might speak freely or reveal his injuries, sits at his giant computer using analysis and rational thought to achieve things his fists cannot, guided by the basic morality exemplified by surrogate father Alfred, who represents his conscience. This part of the superhero could represent that conscience, his superego. Both id and superego influence the ego, which must balance their respective wants to forge its own path, something strong-willed Batman, with his great strength of ego, should handle well. Why is Batman so strong-willed? Where did he get such discipline and self-control? Freud would credit Bruce's toilet training. Freud believed we experience a series of psychosexual stages of development that sculpt our psyches and have lasting impact throughout our lives, each stage focusing on a different erogenous zone, sexually excitable area, with a distinct manner by which we go about satisfying those life-and-death instincts. In any stage, a person might develop a fixation, failing to outgrow that stage emotionally, whether because of trauma, underindulgence, which creates a lingering ache to satisfy unfulfilled needs, or overindulgence, which makes the child too comfortable to want to mature. Whether Bruce's parents died when he was 6, as Frank Miller writes, or 8, according to Dennis O'Neill and others, the boy would have recently passed through the phallic stage's most intense conflict, which Freud considered early life's most important issue. He believed phallic stage fixation could produce narcissism, obsessive self-love, flamboyance, running around wearing a cape surely qualifies, or homosexuality, despite a lack of subsequent evidence to show that he was right about that. While he might have concurred with psychiatrist Frederick Wortham's contention that Bruce Wayne and Dick Grayson were living a homosexual wish dream, Freud did not view homosexuality as deviant. Freud's key ideas about the phallic stage originated in his treatment of a boy he called Little Hans in his writings. Hans suffered such severe equinophobia, fear of horses, that he would barely go outside, horses being as common circa 1900 as cars are today. Freud concluded that the reason Hans was so afraid of being bitten by a horse was that he was in love with his mother and afraid his father was going to castrate him. Freud considered him a little Oedipus, after the figure from Greek tragedy who kills his own father and marries his mother. Hence, the Oedipus complex. Regardless of whether Freud was right about Hans's fear of a horse biting him, symbolizing the deeper fear that his father might castrate him, Hans did have fantasies about marrying mommy, animosity toward his father, and preoccupation with the fear that they might cut off part of his anatomy. Although in his case, he had reason for the castration anxiety. He had been told that if he did not stop fidgeting with his widdler, it would get cut off, and his little sister didn't have one. They'd done it before. Many sources erroneously credit Freud for proposing an equivalent Electra complex for girls when, in fact, Freud refuted Carl Jung's Electra proposal. Freud generalized Hans's phallic preoccupation to all children, positing that castration anxiety worried every little boy, and penis envy irked every little girl. Hans eventually began acting more like his father, incorporating the man's manner and moral values, which Freud interpreted as an act of identification, becoming more like the father in order to get along with him. Each little boy supposedly develops his superego, the conscience, so dad won't threaten his penis, and each little girl develops hers so she can psychologically grow one. In Freud's view, therefore, Bruce has undergone that entire conflict, including a wish to have his father out of the way and occasional resentment toward his mother for being with his father. but could have recently resolved this by identifying with his father and crystallizing his superego, his moral core. Now entering latency, that period of time when Freud, of all people, did not see much of anything sexual going on, the boy would no longer be the sex fiend he was back at age 5. Remember, we're still exploring Planet Freud for the moment. Most of us do not consider preschoolers' underlying motivation primarily sexual in nature. Instead, his mind is opening itself to picking up new skills and learning about the great big world, right when a mugger's bullets shatters that world. Batman vs. Hamlet, Act 1. Murder Most Foul.
Dead! They're dead!
Bruce Wayne, Detective Comics number 33, November 1939.
Murder most foul, as in the best it is, but this most foul, strange and unnatural.
Ghost, Hamlet, Act 1, Scene 5. To help us speculate on what Freud might have said about Batman, we can glean clues by looking at what he had to say about another fictional character whose parents get murdered, a young man with different Oedipal issues, William Shakespeare's Prince Hamlet. Differences between Batman and Hamlet still prove useful in this task. In both stories, the hero's father gets murdered first. Bruce's father, Dr. Thomas Wayne, by a mugger who wants to steal the mother's pearls. Hamlet's father, King Hamlet, by the uncle who wants to steal the mother and the crown. Bruce witnesses the murder. Hamlet later learns his father's death had been a murder. Martha Wayne gets robbed and murdered. Hamlet's mother, Gertrude, marries her husband's murderer and later gets inadvertently murdered by him as well. Bruce has few doubts. Hamlet has them aplenty. Bruce knows that murder has occurred, but not the killer's identity. Hamlet knows the killer's identity, but needs to confirm that it was murder. Bruce Wayne is an active, decisive individual who knows what he wants, forms a plan, and pursues it. Hamlet is passive and uncertain, although to some extent he has good reason to proceed with caution. In case the spirit that visited Hamlet was not actually his father's ghost, but was instead some demon trying to trick him into murdering a man, he first wants to prove murder happened at all. He and Bruce both want to be better than the killers they pursue. They both resist killing. For centuries, scholars have contemplated why Hamlet goes through the elaborate ruse of acting insane while hesitating to kill his uncle, even after establishing the man's guilt. Freud said Hamlet perceives his murderous uncle as the man who shows him the repressed wishes of his own childhood realized. The killer reminds the son, at least unconsciously, of the part of himself that wanted to eliminate his father and have his mother to himself. Freud would likely have considered it significant that Bruce Wayne's father dies first. By taking the mother's necklace, established by later stories to have been a gift from Thomas, a symbol of their affection, and shooting her too, the mugger would remind Bruce of any occasional resentment he'd felt toward her for choosing father over son. Both newly fatherless sons take oaths, whereas Bruce actively chooses to avenge his parents. Hamlet receives a spectral mandate to avenge. Note that in their respective oaths, neither son vows to slay his father's slayer, and neither promises to punish the man who has given his own Oedipal fantasy its reality. Bruce swears to take action, to avenge their deaths by spending the rest of my life warring on all criminals, not to devote himself to hunting down the man who killed them. Hamlet vows inaction, and that he gets his friends to join him in swearing only that they won't tell anybody they saw a ghost. Batman vs. Hamlet, Act 2. The Defense Mechanisms.
Years ago, I created a mighty lie, an almost demonic creature of violence and vengeance. But the lie was born to serve the greater good.
Batman. Batman Absolution, 2003.
Though this be madness, yet there's method in it.
Polonius, Hamlet, Act 2, Scene 2. One area where many psychologists view Freud favorably is his proposal that we use a variety of automatic tactics to protect ourselves from anxiety, especially against threats to self-image,
often without realizing we're using these defense mechanisms or ego defense mechanisms. We all lie to ourselves sometimes. We avoid topics that unnerve us, devalue things we can't have, sour grapes, and shield ourselves from stress in many other ways. Sigmund's daughter, Anna Freud, deserves credit for giving names to numerous processes that her father had described without labeling and for identifying additional defense mechanisms he never addressed. Freud saw Hamlet, Prince of Denmark, as a story of repression, whereby the unconscious mind hides disturbing wishes, thoughts, and experiences from conscious awareness. Unlike Oedipus, who kills his own father and marries his mother, Hamlet sees a man other than himself live out his childhood Oedipal fantasy, a fantasy Freud said Hamlet has repressed. Thus, the loathing which should drive him on to revenge is replaced in him by self-reproaches, by scruples no better than the sinner whom he is to punish. Batman's story, on the other hand, is one of displacement, acting on one's feelings but focusing them on a different target because the original target is inappropriate or unavailable. For example, rather than pursue your roommate's boyfriend whom you find desirable, you convince yourself you're having those feelings about his buddy. Because Batman never brings his parents' killer to justice, every hoodlum he hits serves as a substitute for the man who slayed them. Using defense mechanisms can be healthy, even necessary, to keep harsh reality from overwhelming us. The American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM, distinguishes the defenses that help us best cope with reality. These mature defenses, as Valiant called them, maximize our ability to feel good about life while staying aware of memories, feelings, and thoughts. Hamlet still has his wit, his sense of humor, with a particular fondness for wordplay. But for the most part, he utilizes fewer of these healthier defenses than Batman does. Bruce Wayne lives a life of altruism, self-assertion, and, even as distant as Batman might seem, greater affiliation with his sidekicks, superhero teams, and the rest of Gotham's Bat family, Batgirl, Oracle, etc., than anything Hamlet shows. Although each has a confidant, Alfred for Batman, Horatio for Hamlet, Hamlet more consistently than Batman cuts himself off from all others. Thought suppression helps Batman keep distractions from weakening his focus. But suppressed thoughts remain easily accessible to the conscious mind, unlike all the things Hamlet keeps repressed. Batman exemplifies one definition of the defense, introjection, in that he identifies so strongly with a particular image or symbol that he has incorporated it into his identity. Spending at least 15 years training himself in anticipation of his crime-fighting mission differs markedly from Hamlet's often aimless hesitation. During that anticipatory period, Bruce Wayne passes up opportunities to develop friends and girlfriends, discarding college acquaintances even though he wants them. And the ache he felt seemed to fill his entire being. He learned to ignore the ache and the pain of loss and isolation. These were the conditions of his life, and he accepted them. Social and sexual drives get rerouted into training for his mission. This is an example of sublimation, feeling one need or impulse, but channeling that energy into some other activity. Both Bruce and Hamlet use mental inhibitions, the mildly neurotic defense mechanisms that compromise information, keeping fears and other potential threats hidden from our awareness. Like a police detective who must separate whatever feelings he has about a case from the thoughts and actions needed to do his job, Batman has feelings but must isolate those effective reactions from the brutal reality he faces. He tries not to let shock slow him down or anger blind his perception. He and Hamlet both channel emotional energy into analysis, but Hamlet overanalyzes to the point of intellectualization, using reason to avoid confrontation with an unconscious conflict. Both use reaction formation, a type of sublimation in which the person has one impulse but does the opposite instead, as when they each drive away women they find appealing, in Hamlet's case, cruelly so. Hamlet uses more dysfunctional defenses than Batman. Apathetic withdrawal after his father dies. Idealization of that father. Devaluation of the mother. Rationalization, making excuses for his hesitation to avenge his father even after satisfying himself that his uncle committed murder. And passive aggression throughout. Hamlet is suicidal. Batman is not. He survived that night in the alley and remains a survivor night after night. Batman vs. Hamlet, Act 3. Theatricality and deception. Theatricality and deception are powerful agents. You must become more than just a man in the mind of your opponent. Ducard, Liam Neeson, Batman Begins. We are all errant knaves. Believe none of us. Hamlet. Hamlet, Act 3, Scene 1. Both put on performances, one to expose a villain and the other to scare all villains. Hamlet plays the mad prince. Wayne plays both the bored playboy and the dark symbol that must become more than a man. Deception permeates their relationships, especially those that should be most intimate, with notable exceptions being their respective confidants. And yet they both enlist help in their deceptive practices. Playing mad helps Hamlet hide his suspicions toward his uncle, but does nothing to help him expose or destroy the man. When a troupe of traveling actors happens to come along, Hamlet requests that they perform a specific play so that he might gauge his uncle's reaction when they depict a murder similar to his father's. Even those whom Batman deceives as Bruce Wayne, including Commissioner Gordon, help him with performances of his own. When Hamlet finally uses violence, striking an eavesdropper behind an arras while hoping it's the uncle he still cannot bring himself to confront face to face, he begins to illustrate the advantages of Batman's healthier, more consistently active coping strategies. Hamlet kills the wrong person. Soon he shows signs of psychosis, mental illness, or at least a temporary state in which the person is grossly out of touch with reality, when his father's ghost reappears. But unlike the Act 1 appearance when three others saw the ghost with him, his mother sees no ghost. Either she, having betrayed her late husband by remarrying so soon, is not permitted to see the ghost, or Hamlet is having a hallucination, a psychotic symptom involving a false perception disconnected from real-world stimuli. Batman does not have delusions, beliefs grossly out of touch with reality, nor does he hallucinate, not unless exposed to some supervillain's hallucinogenic toxin, spell, or telepathic whammy. But those are career hazards every superhero faces from time to time. Batman vs. Hamlet. Curtains. My thoughts be bloody or be nothing else. Hamlet. Hamlet, Act 4, Scene 4. Chill. I want to tell you a story without an ending. Maybe you can supply it. Batman to his parents' killer. Batman number 47, 1948. Bruce Wayne carries out a long-term plan that includes avoidance of killing. What little plan Hamlet forms falls apart after he finally, blindly kills. Hamlet's fate demonstrates why Batman draws the line he will not cross. Once the killing starts, the wrong people can suffer, a mistake no one can undo. Of the seven characters killed in Hamlet's latter half, five are not the originally intended or hoped-for targets. Only at the play's end, when Hamlet stabs his uncle and then succumbs to his own envenomed wound, do the intended victims die. Batman gets no Act 5. His story in the comic books does not close. Numerous comics have presented variations of the character's possible future, but never his canonical end. In fact, even those unofficial future tales tend not to end with his death. Parallel universe stories that do depict deaths of other worlds' Batman often confirm that DC's main Batman has followed the wiser path. The rest is silence. Hamlet. Hamlet, Act 5, Final Scene. Here, in the endless cave, far past the burnt remains of a crime fighter whose time has passed, it begins here. Batman's narrative, The Dark Knight Returns, final page. The Inner Child, Robin. He was about the same age I was when my parents died. His parents, circus acrobats, had been murdered, and I wanted to make a difference in his life. The way, if my parents had lived, they would have made a difference in mine. Batman. Batman number 618, 2003. Whereas Sigmund Freud emphasized the importance of life's earliest years and would have dwelled on the Wayne's deaths, Carl Jung considered individuation, individual personality growth, integrating diverse aspects of oneself to form a whole and healthy identity, a lifelong process, and would have cast his gaze wider across the entire course of Bruce Wayne's life. Despite acknowledging that early experience influences us, Jung felt that psychological disturbances are more rooted in the present than in the past, and that therapists should spend more time helping clients with the direction they're taking into the future. Both would have said that Robin, the Boy Wonder, reminds Batman of himself and the reason for his mission. Robin is a living symbol of the boy Bruce had been when he lost his parents, and the boy he might have become under other circumstances. After all, Dick Grayson looks like young Bruce. His parents resemble Bruce's, and both are about the same age when they witness their respective parents' murders. Subsequent boys wonder, Jason, Tim, and Damian, all look like young Bruce, and Batman swiftly fires the only official girl wonder, blonde Stephanie Brown. Through Robin, Batman receives vicarious wish fulfillment as he helps the boy get what young Bruce did not. Guidance, crime fighting as a father and son activity, justice, and thus closure. In their first case together, Batman and Robin send the Grayson's killer to jail. Freud and Jung would have disagreed a bit on why Batman welcomes that symbol of his own childhood. Looking at how past crisis lingers with us via processes like fixation and repression, Freud might say that little boy Bruce, having never outgrown that night, always remains an important part of Batman's fixated psyche. Jung, on the other hand, felt that past conflicts tend to influence us most when present difficulties bring them up again. Regression, another defense mechanism, involves seeking comfort by reverting to behavior from an earlier point in life, like the toilet-trained child who resumes bedwetting during her parents' divorce, or the ex-smoker who lights up while going bankrupt. Jung agreed that boys experience the Oedipus conflict, but he felt that it was unlikely to play an important role later unless the man reacted to current parental issues, e.g., Hamlet's ire toward his mother for remarrying so soon, by regressing or emotionally returning to a conflict long since left behind. For Batman, Robin is not an unconscious symbol, but rather a conscious reminder. In Robin's debut, the narrative tells us, the Batman thinks back to the time when his parents, too, were innocent victims of a criminal. And he tells Dick, my parents, too, were killed by a criminal. That's why I've devoted my life to exterminate them. By helping the boy get justice, Batman returns to his parents' murder and gets to experience what a better post-murder outcome could have felt like. Jung would also examine Robin's role as a symbol of the child archetype, and that child's place in the hero's journey. Jung's archetypes. Shadow of the Bat. Patients suffering delusional episodes often focus their paranoia on an external tormentor, usually one conforming to Jungian archetypes. Dr. Jonathan Crane, a.k.a. the Scarecrow, Killian Murphy, Batman Begins, 2008 motion picture. Carl Jung, 1875 to 1961, mentioned Superman in his work, seeing Superman as the main personality and Clark Kent as Superman's shadow. But we can only speculate on how he'd have assessed Batman. Of particular importance is Jung's theory that the collective unconscious, an inborn stratum of the psyche inherited by all humankind, prepares us to perceive and create themes that fit abstract, instinctive patterns called archetypes that organize the things we see and do.
Certain themes and character types emerge in the legends and myths of every culture in the history of the world. Jung said the archetypal pattern is not a question of inherited ideas, but of inherited possibilities of ideas. The Joker is no more an inherent feature of every human psyche than is the mischievous Norse god Loki. But each has qualities common to rascally characters that stir trouble, challenge heroes, and push mortals on to greater heights in tales told throughout time. They are symbols of the trickster archetype. Each fits within its mold, imperfectly sculpted with touches added and bits trimmed away by myriad storytellers over the course of many years. Jungian therapy involved helping the client both face reality and delve into the unconscious. In early treatment, the client encounters the principal features of the personal unconscious, the part of the unconscious gathered over a lifetime, not inherited. The shadow and the persona. The shadow represents your dark side, not necessarily your evil side, but the part of you that is hidden out of the light. The sum of those characteristics you wish to conceal from both the world and yourself. We fear it. In Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, a potion that Henry Jekyll hopes might eliminate evil releases a person's darkest inclinations instead, and lets his shadow take control. Appropriately enough, given that Walter Gibson's The Shadow helped inspire the Dark Knight's creation, Batman is a shadow character. Bruce Wayne confronts his own darkest nature early in life, chooses to work with it, and uses it to instill fear in others. His bright and dark sides work together to fight evil. Superheroes commonly have shadow foes, enemies that are twisted counterparts to themselves. Flash, Reverse Flash, Green Lantern, Sinestro the Yellow Lantern, Brutal Gamma-Mutated Hulk, Supersmart Gamma-Mutated Leader. These twists take many forms. Superman has both Bizarro, a dim-witted super-strong freak who does harm through his ignorance, and Lex Luthor, a non-superpowered scientist who does intentional evil for self-serving purposes. Each a funhouse distortion from a different angle. Because Batman is himself a shadow character, his shadow foes become more freakish, more complicated than strong, dumb, amoral, or mortal, smart, immoral. Inspired by a movie poster featuring Spencer Tracy's Jekyll on half his face and his version of Hyde down the other, Two-Face mirrors the entire character, both Batman and Bruce Wayne at the same time, but with both his sides furthering evil. By letting a coin toss absolve him of guilt and responsibility for his bad side's actions, the villain's unscarred good Harvey Dent side also serves wrongdoing. The Joker, laughing, murderous, psychopathic, brightly colored clown prince of crime, shadows only Batman, not the whole character. The Joker has no alter ego. Despite some depictions, most notably when mobster Jack Napier becomes the Joker in Tim Burton's Batman, the comic book Joker has no secret identity, no confirmable past prior to the incident that turned him green-haired and chalk-white, and for his first decade of publication, no origin at all. "Sometimes I remember it one way, sometimes another," he tells Batman in Alan Moore's graphic novel The Killing Joke. "If I'm going to have a past, I prefer it to be multiple choice." Because the Joker does not want Batman to have an alter ego, he threatens the lives of those who might expose the hero's unmasked identity. He does not want to see Batman by daylight. He refuses to recognize any brighter facets of Batman's persona. The persona is the mask, essentially a collection of masks that the ego wears when interacting with the outer world. You wear many masks. You bring a different set of qualities to different situations, and they all might be equally genuine. The face you wear on Saturday night may not be the face you wear on Sunday morning. The persona helps keep the shadow hidden. If balance between the two breaks down, a persona-dominated person will worry too much what people think, or a shadow-dominated person might recognize no law beyond his own instant gratification. The Joker hates the nice, bright masks people wear. He strives to smash masks, trying to unleash people's shadow selves on the assumption that they're all monstrous at heart.
After the client faces those features of the personal unconscious, a Jungian therapist helps the person look at deeper aspects of the collective unconscious, beginning with the contrasexual archetypes, each gender's innate sense of the opposite sex. Jung said every man carries an archetypal representation of woman, his anima, and each woman carries one of man, her animus. He said each gender has a sense of what it would mean for the two to join as soulmates, a divine couple in a relationship called the syzygy, named for alignment of the planets. Batman's attraction to Catwoman, established when he lets her escape in her first appearance, even though he has nice girl Julie Madison in his life at the time, hints at his anima's nature. Because he thinks of Batman as his true self, he desires a woman more like his shadow than his persona. But because he is more than merely shadow, he can never fully trust her or keep any woman continuously in his personal life. The Golden Age Batman and Catwoman had to retire from crime fighting and crime respectively before they could balance their complex nature and spend most of their remaining years as a happy couple. The maturing individual encounters representations of all the archetypes while progressing toward wholeness of being. The self is the archetype of the individual's greatest potential, where all aspects come together as one. The hero story archetype reflects the individuating person making that trek from balancing shadow and persona to become, eventually, possibly, the self. The hero's journey. Elaborating upon Jung's writings on heroes, Joseph Campbell, 1904 to 1987, referred to the monomyth, the hero's journey, as the archetypal myth at the foundation of every heroic tale. In The Hero with a Thousand Faces, 1949, he described the steps heroes tend to take. Departure, meaning the separation from their early lives. The Waynes get murdered, Bruce leaves Gotham. Initiation, a series of trials that lead to achievement of the ultimate boon, the goal of that hero's quest. Bruce trains under many teachers until ready to don cape and cowl. Return, coming back to bestow his boon upon others. Batman comes to Gotham. Having gained wisdom, skills, and any other divine gifts, the hero returns to become a master of two worlds. Comic scholar Peter Coogan has observed that the entire journey takes place within the hero's origin story. The classical monomyth, identified by Joseph Campbell, clearly serves as a model for the origin stories of superheroes. Batman Year One and Batman Begins offer glimpses into that journey, if only its first and final parts. Aside from their brief origin stories, the most prominent superheroes' adventures rarely explore many steps within the monomythic arc. The television program Smallville, a notable exception in its portrayal of young Clark Kent growing into his Superman role. Batman is a hero complete. As if to satisfy the inherent craving for tales of becoming heroes, the creators added a hero incomplete, a student for Batman to mentor, a boy wonder who will grow up. Case File 9-1. Two-Face. Real name, Harvey Dent. First appearance, Detective Comics number 66, August 1942. Origin. Handsome District Attorney Harvey Apollo Dent fights to clean up corruption as the face of honor and justice in Gotham City. Not above bending rules to advance that goal and frustrated by mobsters who bribe authorities so they can operate above the law, he becomes an early ally helping the bat-masked vigilante who crosses a line we can't. After a crime boss scars the attorney's face with acid, leaving his face divided into beauty and ugliness, Dent wants to hurt others. Relinquishing responsibility for his own actions, he begins making decisions based on the toss of a two-headed coin. Clean side up, do good. Scarred side up, do wrong. The only morality in a cruel world is chance. Unbiased, unprejudiced, fair. Harvey Dent, Two-Face, Aaron Eckhart. The Dark Knight, 2008 Motion Picture. If Dent now believes random chance controls people's actions and fates, then he believes in external causality. Your locus of control is your generalized expectancy or set of beliefs regarding your ability to influence events. With internal locus, you tend to think your own skills and efforts determine the quality of your health, achievements, social interactions, and other life circumstances. With external locus, you attribute causality to things beyond your control, like weather, other people, predestination, or blind, stupid, simple, doo-dah, clueless luck. Successful people tend to make internal attributions, taking personal responsibility for completing tasks and reaching goals. Few people are 100% internal or 100% external. We often mix and match however makes us feel best. For example, regardless of our general tendencies, we nevertheless tend to make internal attributions about favorable outcomes. I made an A, and external attributions about unfavorable ones. The professor gave me an F. Harvey Dent, having climbed the career ladder to become district attorney and ambitiously determined to challenge all its corruption, appears to have had an internal locus before tragedy taught him that life is random and he should trust only fate. Maybe that experience changed his basic beliefs. On the other hand, he may be using that lesson as an excuse to lash out at the world. Now that he has begun to steal and kill, to exercise power over life and death, he might still believe in Harvey Dent, even though he'd rather not. Because holding himself accountable for his transgressions disturbs Dent, Freud might say that the character asserts the reverse of his core belief as a defense mechanism. Reaction formation, outwardly transforming a belief or inclination into its opposite, helps him avoid judging himself by his own standards. In other words, Dent at heart still believes himself responsible for his actions, accountability he prefers not to think about, so he lets a coin toss excuse his actions. He generally does not care which evil things he does, as long as he gets to do some. When he tries to force others to see the randomness of life, he is trying to convince himself. Although writers sometimes refer to Two-Face as having multiple personalities, depictions of him rarely meet any diagnostic criteria for what is now called dissociative identity disorder, DID. See case study 2-1, King Tut. With DID, good Harvey would take control for periods of time, and his bad side would take its turn, with at least one identity unable to recall things that happened when the other took over. But no, both sides consistently stay with him. Exceptions in the literature do appear. More than a year after plastic surgery repairs his face, a year when he fights crime rather than committing it, an overstressed Dent hears his dark side telling him to let it out to play until he scars himself deliberately to become Two-Face once more. While some DID patients report hearing their alter personalities, their other selves, that is not an essential feature for a DID diagnosis. The first story to present Harvey Dent and Two-Face as separate entities, taking distinct turns controlling one body, was The Great Leap, in which Harvey Dent asks Nightwing to protect a woman from a mob killer who later turns out to be Two-Face. Could Two-Face's dual nature have evolved into DID over time? That's hard to say. After all these years, we barely understand multiple personality. Dissociative experience is so subjective that professionals cannot even agree on whether it exists. As mentioned when we looked at the persona archetype, we all have variable personality states. If your Sunday morning self suppresses thoughts about your Saturday night self's actions, there's nothing to stop you from slapping a name on your Saturday side. I sometimes demonstrate this by asking a student volunteer questions in front of a class. When asked to speak to that student's angry self, the person frowns, neck stiffens, and tone toughens up. When I request the student's 5-year-old self, the eyebrows lift, head bobs, and tone becomes childlike. Everyone does that, under no hypnosis and with no preparation. When I ask for the angry or child self's real name, half the volunteers will offer a new name. Now imagine doing this in a therapeutic situation, especially while hypnotized. If Dent deals with Arkham Asylum therapists who believe he has DID, their therapeutic techniques may train him to emphasize division between his halves. When therapy causes or exacerbates mental illness, we refer to that process as iatrogenesis. Harvey Dent seeks excuses. Attributing his misdoings to another self could absolve good Harvey even further than leaving decisions to his deliberate coin toss. After all these years, Harvey may be trying to convince himself he has multiple personality. Chapter 10. The Kids. Why Robin? Young men with a mind for revenge don't need encouragement. They need guidance. Alfred Michael Goff, Batman Forever, 1995. Why does Batman work with a partner? And why is his crime-fighting partner a kid? Batman never sets out to recruit any partner. The partners each want to work with him. Each has been a youngster who already possesses the skills to combat or commit crimes, along with a personal grievance against evildoers. Each Robin picks Batman, not the other way around, with one notable exception that Batman would come to consider his greatest failure. Robin Begins. I had always thought Robin was a real pain in the ass, but I now realize what a brilliant creation it was, because it really does give a human context to Batman's character. Frank Miller on including a Robin in the apocryphal The Dark Knight Returns, Comics Interview, 1986. The question of why Robin is at least as important outside the fiction as within it. Why did the grown men writing those early comic books add a child to the stories, and why did readers accept the addition? A character's narrative function, its storytelling purpose, is a psychological function. Not only does the act of telling stories have both therapeutic and harmful potential for both storyteller and audience, depending on the circumstances and nature of the story told, but the storyteller crafts the stories and characters to suit the audience's psychological processes, including motivations, emotions, and cognitive abilities. Narrative intent and success depend on the storyteller's theory of mind, his or her personal theory regarding other people's mental activity. Your personal theory of mind involves attributing mental states, including thoughts, feelings, motives, knowledge, and perception, to oneself, others, and even fictional characters. Creating a fictional character, therefore constructing an imaginary psyche, and crafting a story to evoke specific reactions from living, non-fictional readers, will depend, whether intuitively or intentionally, on your metacognition, what you know and think about how cognitive processes like knowing and thinking work. The original answer to why Robin is that Bill Finger quickly tired of writing Batman's thought balloons. He wanted Batman to talk. Whenever he works alone, Batman is silent and more violent. Short on candid interactions with others, he can seem as distant to readers as he does to the criminals he intimidates. The alternative, revealing all his thoughts and feelings through thought balloons, can expose the mystery man too much. A partner provides the balance to reveal his nature as needed while still maintaining his mystique. Finger recounted, Robin was an outgrowth of a conversation I had with Bob. As I said, Batman was a combination of Fairbanks and Sherlock Holmes. Holmes had his Watson. The thing that bothered me was that Batman didn't have anyone to talk to, and it got a little tiresome always having him thinking. I found, as I went along, Batman needed a Watson to talk to. Bob Kane thought the partner should be a boy to whom their readers could relate. Finger agreed. Identification, connecting one's own identity to someone else's by perceiving shared characteristics, makes us feel bonded to others, even those we don't personally know, including celebrities and fictional characters. With that goal in mind, artist Jerry Robinson, who helped Kane design the partner's costume, suggested they name the boy after Robin Hood, so that readers would associate this new character with both a popular hero and real boys.
Robin was more human, Robinson recalled. A real boy's name, rather than one that implied some powers.
So in April 1940, Batman's 12th month of publication, he became a surrogate papa.
Dick Grayson.
In Detective Comics number 38, to intimidate a circus owner into paying protection money, gangsters tamper with trapeze ropes so they'll break during acrobats John and Mary Grayson's death-defying triple spin. The flying Graysons plunge to their deaths before the collective eyes of their son, Dick, and that night's entire audience, which happens to include Bruce Wayne. When Dick wants to go to the police with what he knows about the gangsters, Batman warns him that a mobster called Boss Zucco runs the town.
If you told what you knew, you'd be dead in an hour.
Batman plans to hide the boy, but then he thinks back to his own origin.
Batman, my parents too were killed by a criminal. That's why I've devoted my life to exterminate them.
Dick, then I want to also. Take me with you, please.
Narrative. The Batman is reluctant, but the troubled face of the boy moves him deeply.
Batman.
Well, I guess you and I were both victims of a similar trouble.
All right. I'll make you my aid.
But I warn you, I lead a perilous life.
Dick. I'm not afraid.
In an image reminiscent of one reader saw when they learned Batman's origin just 5 months earlier, the new boy swears an oath to fight against crime and corruption, and never to swerve from the path of righteousness. Training progresses quickly for the boy, who has been doing acrobatics since he was 4 years old, with Bruce acknowledging that Dick could probably teach me a thing or two. And soon they take Boss Zucco to jail. The Graysons swiftly receive the justice that the Waynes never got. Their son will not grow up forever aching to avenge them. In fact, he cheerfully ends his first adventure by declaring, I can hardly wait till we go on our next case. I bet it'll be a corker. Where the pulps that originally shaped Batman's stories had been grim, lacking in humor, Finger noted that Robin, with his ebullient smile and bright red, yellow, and green costume, altered the comic's look and mood. The dialogue was easy, fluid, and flowing. It brightened up the strip and added characterization to the main figure of Batman. Kane had not intended to change the tone of the book, nor had they introduced Robin in order to humanize Batman. Rather, these consequences evolved naturally. Sales double, Batman starts smiling, and oh, the sidekicks. Apprentice crime fighters pop up all over the place. Captain America gets Bucky fighting Nazis by his side. The Human Torch finds Toro. Sandman, Sandy. Green Arrow, Speedy. Mr. Scarlet, Pinky. Aquaman, Aqualad, and so on. Superheroes get busy endangering children left and right. The most successful of these spunky orphan characters have adventures apart from their mentors. Robin enjoys many solo adventures, and the competitions Bucky and Toro lead the young allies. Whether in The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, The Goonies, Spy Kids, Our Gang shorts, or a whole host of modern young adult fiction, we more readily suspend disbelief and accept fictional youngsters having adventures when the kids venture off on their own. Adults get in the way for both readers and young protagonists. This would become increasingly important over the upcoming decades as comic book readership grew older. Through the 1950s, the sidekicks appear less frequently, whether because superhero comics in general had lost some of their popularity or because psychiatrist Frederick Wortham's 1954 book, Seduction of the Innocent, with its insinuations about Batman and Robin's lifestyle, raised questions of pedophilia in readers' minds regarding all these superheroes and their young wards. See Case File 10-2, Dr. Frederick Wortham. The major comic book companies start separating the sidekicks from their mentors. In the 1960s, Marvel Comics kills off Bucky and Toro, while DC emancipates its minors and makes them start growing up. Robin the Boy Wonder becomes the Teen Wonder, leading the Teen Titans as a whole team of sidekicks operating independently of their mentors. These kids age. The Titans, seemed to be about 13 years old when they formed their super team in 1965, and by 1970, they seemed to be about 18. They interacted with college kids as equals, a match of narrative and chronological time. Through the 1960s, in an era of disillusionment, time progresses for characters at both DC and Marvel. In a climate of American assassinations and conflict in Vietnam, the super children grow up with the audience. The readership's average age kept going up, and comics matured with them. The rather illogical tradition of adult superheroes taking on teenage sidekicks, often with no powers, in the dangerous fight against the very powerful forces of evil, grew harder to accept. Illogical circumstances unquestioned by preschool children in the pre-operational stage of cognitive development, those too young to consider others' viewpoints and perform more logical mental operations, wouldn't cut it, and even the simple logic and deduction accepted by elementary school-aged children in the concrete operational stage grew shaky. An aging audience meant that in addition to wanting more mature subject matter and more sophisticated storytelling, adolescent and older readers utilizing the systematic reasoning of the formal operational stage might reevaluate previously accepted story elements and decide, that's just stupid. With the newness of formal operations upon them, and without the perspective of more years, adolescents can have difficulty looking past a stupid obstacle. In 1969, with the campy Batman TV series now canceled, writer Dennis O'Neill and artist Neil Adams brought the comic book Batman back to his darker roots. DC ships Dick Grayson off to college. Robin continues to fight crime, but on his own, with Batgirl, or as the Teen Titans leader into the 1980s, until the young man walks away from his Robin identity, taking on a new masked persona to operate under the name Nightwing. During those teen wonder years, while Batman often operates on his own in the pages of Batman and Detective Comics, Alfred grows in importance and evolves, in the Batcave and at Bruce's home, into Batman's Watson. Even though he doesn't go out prowling the night by Batman's side and trade quips in combat, Denny and other writers had to write a lot of thought bubbles. Readers got to enjoy more interactive dialogue over in Batman's team-up series, The Brave and the Bold, until it ended in 1983, the year for big changes in the Bat titles. As Nightwing, Dick Grayson is a strong and popular character, fighting crime without the burden of Batman's darkness. In many ways, Bruce Wayne's hopes fulfilled. Jason Todd, number one. With the Brave and the Bold team-ups having ended, and Dick Grayson having outgrown his sidekick role, the narrative needs that had inspired Robin's original creation resurfaced, and the disadvantages of having Batman operate without a sidekick to talk to became apparent again. Enter Jason Todd. Mandated by DC executives to make the new kid a carbon copy of Dick Grayson, writer Jerry Conway and artist Don Newton introduced Jason as yet another boy whose acrobat parents get killed by criminals. Through his circus connections, Dick, not Bruce, first meets Jason and his parents before the deaths. The first Batman ever sees of this new kid is when a grieving Jason in Robin-like costume jumps out to attack his parents' killer. Batman experiences a surge of déjà vu. The caped figure crashing into the unconscious Killer Croc could be another boy from long ago. Where Dick reminded Batman of young Bruce Wayne, Jason reminds Batman of young Dick Grayson. That was Jason version number one, commonly known as pre-crisis Jason Todd. Associating this character so strongly with Dick Grayson for the readers by making Jason identify with Dick within the fiction allowed for a relatively smooth transition from the first Robin to the second. Too smooth for dramatic purposes, some of the storytellers came to decide. Replacement Robin Rebooted. Jason Todd, number two. 1986 changed DC's superheroes. Crisis on Infinite Earths collapsed DC's rich multiverse, all of its parallel universes and alternate futures, into a single universe, one merged timeline with new character histories. Outside that new universe's official canon, DC published arguably the most influential deconstructions of superheroes with Watchmen, which explored how brutal and unpleasant superheroes' lives would be in general, and The Dark Knight Returns, a possible future tale that changed how readers looked at Batman in particular. These gritty alternate reality tales, respective authors,